This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, with my special guest today, Ace Baker, who is switching roles with me, and Ace is interviewing me today instead of me interviewing Ace. We've had a few preliminary questions from Ace, but I'm glad to turn the mic over to him once again.
Well, hi, Jim. So now, you came to Southern California, what was that, a couple of months ago or something, and paid me a visit in my studio, and we hung out for a little while. We took a little look at some pieces of my movie that I'm still working on, and we had a little chat, and did a little interview, and had a talk. And
yeah, I was out there. I was out there in California for my 50th high school reunion. I was actually staying with a friend who, a former colleague from the University of Kentucky, where I had my first academic appointment that began in 1970, and commuting from La Jolla up to Pasadena, where these events were taking place. And it seemed to me on Saturday that I had enough time, and I very much look forward to having a chance to talk with you. So we arranged for me to do that, and I stopped by on my way up to a restaurant located in the vicinity of Rose Bowl, where we were having our Saturday event.
But that day, one of the things I expressed to you was my disappointment with various researchers in the 9/11 movement that I know and have interacted with, Stephen Jones, Judy Wood, and others. And I was expressing disappointment and how I just wasn't altogether altogether sure that they were who they were purporting to be. And you said to me that you felt at times that you and I were the only two people who were actually trying to get to the truth of 9/11. And I want to know if, first of all, if you'll confirm for your audience that you said that to me, and if you meant it, and if you still feel that way.
Well, I did say it, and I did mean it, and I sometimes have felt that way, Ace. So, you know, it's not that I always feel that way, but sometimes, you know, the whole business of 9/11 is getting so bizarre, so weird, and some of the personalities and relationships so convoluted. I do believe that the persons like, the, you know, David Ray Griffin and Elias Davidson and any number of others are also sincerely trying to discover the truth, but I have been extremely dismayed by the convoluted fashion in which these personal interactions have taken place. I mean, Judy Wood is a particularly disappointing case to me because I have spent so much time making her work available to a larger audience, defending it. I've learned probably more from her about what happened in New York than from any other source. I frequently recommended her website, drjudywood.com. And yet Judy, in my opinion, because of my skepticism about her association with this fellow John Hutchison, has basically shut me off and cut me down to other groups, for example, who might have been interested in having me speak. I take it this is the case with a Portland 9/11 truth group, or so I have been told. She has posted ridiculous comments on her website criticizing me for asking questions about John Hutchison with regard to his background and education, and suggesting, for example, that I hadn't asked you similar questions. And yet I knew plenty about you and your background and your abilities through our interaction, and I know virtually nothing about Hutchison. And when he's making these extraordinary claims that seem to defy conventional physics, for me to not ask questions about his background and training would have been utterly irresponsible. So here you have Judy Wood attacking me for asking responsible questions about John Hutchison, primarily out of concern that her association with him might tarnish her own work, because those who are in a position to know more about his purported field of expertise, which basically is that of electromagnetism, have told me that Hutchison is not taken seriously and that his products are generally viewed as fraudulent. And while, you know, I have had my concerns and suspicions, I was certainly dramatically moved in that direction by your capacity to recreate videos like the videos he's produced as evidence of what he's done. And when Judy attacked you for making fake videos, I found that irresponsible, intellectually irresponsible, because what you were doing was showing how easy it is to fake videos that would reveal or disclose the same effects that he was claiming from what, of course, on his side were purporting to be real videos. And so, you know, Judy seems to me to have lost her way, and I'm really sorry to say that that's the case, because, of course, she was a major speaker, as were you, at the 9/11 conference in Madison. And I, you know, not only featured her work prominently in my first book on 9/11, the 9/11 conspiracy, but I had intended to do so in my second book, which I'm editing now, the 9/11 controversies. But Judy has basically shut me off. She doesn't respond to my invitations to come on the show. I send her and Jerry Liepart and Morgan Reynolds, both of whom I continue to hold in high esteem, all copies of articles or results or reports that I think might be of interest to them. I even contacted Judy to suggest that we might, after Sophia had broached the idea with me, that it might be a good thing to advertise the DVD from the Madison Conference, which is entitled The Science and Politics of 9/11, on her website, and that I'd be glad to, you know, give her a royalty for every copy of the DVD that was sold that way. But even though it prominently features her work, and in my opinion this is probably the best, I mean, it's 14 hours of very serious, substantial presentations, including, of course, your own, Morgan Reynolds, others by Lorraine Moray and Alfred Weber, and a good many other persons, even including Kevin Barrett and Barbara Honegger, Jerry Liepart himself, Bob Fitrakis. She never even responded. So to me, this is, you know, this is not professional conduct. It's not even, doesn't even satisfy minimal conditions for manners and propriety. So I'm very, very disappointed in Judy Wood.
Man, you mentioned a number of different people, and I want to talk about some others that you didn't mention in a minute. But
sure.
Let me ask you. Were there real plane crashes at the World Trade Center?
I think the weight of the evidence suggests there were not, and I've been powerfully affected by work that you have done, Killtown has done. It goes all the way back, I guess, to Gerald Holmgren, who always came across as such an obsessively obnoxious human being that it was very difficult to have any serious human interaction or intellectual interaction with him. But I, as you know, I separate the issue into two different parts. One is video fakery, and the other is the planes and no planes, to which I'll return after this break with my special guest, Ace Maker. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, with my special guest today, Ace Maker. In a reversal of roles, Ace is interviewing me instead of my interviewing him, which I thought was a great way to start off the new year. On this new program, Ace has asked me a question that I've only begun to address, namely whether I believe that planes or no planes hit the buildings on the World Trade Center. And I've explained how the weight of the evidence suggests to me that probably no planes hit the building. But I want to, you know, just review some of the principles of reasoning involved here. Someone who comes from a background like mine is going to treat a question like this with a bit more circumspection from the point of view of what others might view as logical niceties, so that while, you know, some may want to press for a simple yes or no, I think the situation is not quite that easily addressed, in particular in scientific inquiries. There are four stages. Puzzlement, some phenomenon occurs, it's puzzling, doesn't fit into your background understanding, it requires investigation to sort out. Speculation, looking at the full range of alternative possible explanations that, if they were true, would account for and resolve the puzzlement. Number three, adaptation, adapting the evidence, the hypotheses to the evidence, and measuring the strength of evidential support they receive from the available data, where that is done in terms of what are known as technically as likelihoods, where the likelihood of an hypothesis H, given evidence E, is equal to the probability of E if H, if that hypothesis were true. Now, in scientific inquiries, we distinguish between, at least I do in my articulation of these principles, between hypotheses that are preferable and hypotheses that are acceptable. An hypothesis is preferable when it has a higher likelihood than any alternative. In other words, when it's the one that seems to provide the best explanation. But it's also then acceptable when sufficient evidence becomes available. When you have sufficient evidence available, when the evidence is all more or less settled down, in other words, all points in the same direction, then you're entitled to accept the hypothesis that has the highest likelihood. Now, there's one further distinction to be drawn, which is this. I take it that a hypothesis has been established beyond reasonable doubt when no alternative explanation is reasonable. I believe that the occurrence of video fakery has not only assumed the status of being the preferable hypothesis in relation to the video phenomena that was emerging on 9/11 from New York, but is also an acceptable hypothesis that we now have sufficient evidence that all points in the same direction for that hypothesis to be acceptable. I even believe that there's really no reasonable alternative in the case of video fakery as an hypothesis once you understand the evidence. Now, the problem when we have a whole bunch of individual researchers who have very dissimilar backgrounds, who have a very different understanding of the nature of logic and its relation to evidence and so forth, and who may not be familiar with all and only the same evidence, is that they can perfectly sincerely arrive at different conclusions about which is the preferable hypothesis or whether it's acceptable as well, much less whether it's been established beyond a reasonable doubt by virtue of these background differences in their knowledge and understanding. But I submit, and as a characteristic of scientific objectivity, that everyone, every inquirer who's confronted with the same hypotheses as alternatives and the same body of evidence and applying the same rules of reasoning, those that I'm articulating here, would arrive at the same conclusions about which hypotheses are acceptable, which are rejectable, and which should be left in suspense, meaning neither accepted nor rejected, typically because there's simply not sufficient evidence to establish that. In relation to no planes, the weight of the evidence suggests to me that there probably were no planes, that that's the most likely hypothesis. And I think there's, you know, sufficient evidence accumulating that it may be, it's, you know, verging toward the point of being an acceptable hypothesis. And I know for some who are more, you know, thoroughly familiar with the evidence than am I, like yourself, that it's really a matter of beyond a reasonable doubt. But I'm in the same situation as everyone else with respect to having to make my judgments by applying these principles to the evidence that, as I understand it, and when you have what I would grant is a superior understanding of the evidence, that it may be more clear-cut to you than it is to me, but that's only because I don't understand the evidence and the arguments as well as you do. And this is hardly surprising because you have a virtuosity in many areas in relation to digital processing and analyzing videos and films and so forth than have I. But I think it's because of this, Ace, that sometimes someone, you know, who is in a superior position from the point of view of knowledge and belief, such as yourself, becomes impatient with someone even as sophisticated about reasoning as am I, because I haven't gone as far as you have gone only by virtue of not yet having understood the evidence as well as you understand it. I think when I reach that point, I'll probably be inclined to conclude, as I believe you have concluded, that the absence of planes in New York on 9/11 is actually beyond reasonable doubt. I'm not there yet, but certainly the evidence leans in that direction. I think there's no alternative hypothesis that has as high a likelihood as that there were no planes. So, you know, I think the evidence is very, very, is accumulating, and you have more than enough to accept that hypothesis. I'm inclined to accept it. But just to be, you know, very precise about where I stand and why I think sometimes, you know, your conversations with me have left you a bit frustrated, because for me it wasn't quite so categorical in terms of yes or no as it is to you, based upon your superior understanding of the evidence.
You mentioned a point in the scientific process where the evidence settles down. So it's at some point the evidence is turbulent, there's new stuff coming in all the time, and then at some point it sort of settles down. There is, I would say that the evidence on video fakery and video compositing and no planes is pretty settled down. But there, as you know, there's a wealth of new material that's coming out all the time. And there's a number of researchers, would include Killtown in this, a guy called Fred B.S. Registration, a guy called Simon Schack, who is, of course, the creator of the September Clues series of videos. And
did he also create the 9/11 Amateur series, too?
Right. I mean, I thought that was sort of all part of it.
Yeah.
Simon Schack, also known as Social Service. And this group of people and others, and I would include Web Fairy, Rosalie Grable in this group, and also Nico Haupt, otherwise known as E-Wing 2001, have been producing a lot of new material lately for the last year and a half and right up to this day that is arguing that the 9/11 videos were much more than real video with a fake airplane inserted, as I believe, and I believe I've proven, but actually were completely animated videos. They point to things like the Verrazano Narrows Bridge in the background of some shots, which appears to move, shift from side to side. They point to buildings that they say are actually missing from videos that ought to be there. Buildings that move incorrectly. Missing backgrounds where there's just a blank background that they say ought to actually have buildings and so forth in it. All of which they say points to the notion that the videos were completely animated by some top-secret, unknown technology. I actually spoke with Simon Schack a few weeks ago. And is that the cue music? Yeah.
We'll be right. So, right back with my special guest, Ace Baker. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, with my special guest today, Ace Baker, where Ace and I are reversing roles today, and Ace is interviewing me. Ace, I understand the question. Would you like to extend it, or would you like me to respond to it?
Yeah, that's basically it. I was just talking about this total animation crew, and I just wanted to ask you if you had any thoughts on that line of research. If you've been
I probably, you're more familiar with the latest there than am I, but I've seen some of the videos to which you're making reference, where the Verrazano Bridge, for example, seems to move in the background, which is inconsistent with the camera in the building and seems to reveal a form of fakery. Now, in the history of research on JFK, there's been a kind of constant proliferation of new evidence, most of which is fabricated or faked, that has been thrown into the mix to try to lead the uninitiated, the unwary, to suppose that, oh, maybe Lee Oswald actually did assassinate JFK, after all, as the government has maintained, by those who are unaware that the weapon he's alleged to have used cannot have fired the bullets that killed the president, because he was killed by the impact of high-velocity bullets, but the weapon he used was not a high-velocity weapon, that he wasn't even on the sixth floor but was down on the first floor in a lunchroom where he was confronted by a motorcycle officer within 90 seconds of the assassination, and where he'd been observed in and around by co-workers at 10 minutes, at 12, at 12, at 12:15, as late as 12:25 by Carolyn Arnold, the executive secretary to the vice president of the Book Depository. So he didn't have the means and he didn't have the opportunity. And indeed, Marina, his wife, said that he admired JFK and held no malice toward him, which means the guy the government fingered in this case had neither the motive nor means nor opportunity. Now, there's a seeming ongoing set of videos of pseudo documentary programs that purport to show that Oswald really could have killed JFK using Amanda Kirk-Arcano and firing from above and down at him, and all of them are riddled with misrepresentations, outright falsehoods, gross discrepancies. The most recent was a Discovery Channel piece entitled JFK Inside the Target Car, which was moderated by the curator of the Sixth Floor Museum, a fellow named Gary Mack, who at one time did good work on JFK, but who's become nothing but a stooge for the government. And if you're knowledgeable about the case with regard to this Inside the Target Car, they're trying to establish or evaluate possible shooting locations to determine if any locations from the front were reasonable locations. And Mack takes this Australian marksman, who's quite a good shot, to several different locations, including several from which we have already determined that shots actually were fired. And he takes him to the south side of the Triple Underpass and goes forward, which is a real awkward position that no one has ever alleged a shot was fired from. And the marksman reported this was not a suitable location. Then he takes him to the vicinity of the above-ground sewer opening and asks him if this is a good location. He starts to explain, yes, it's a pretty good location, but you'd have to fire through the windshield. So Mack immediately takes him over to the north side as though firing through the windshield were somehow out of the question, when we've established that Jack was shot in the throat by a bullet that passed through the windshield. It makes many witnesses there reported that the first shot sounded different than the rest. It sounded like a firecracker. There's a fellow named Jim Lewis who's going through shooting through junk vehicles in the south to determine whether or not you could make such a shot by putting a dummy in the back seat. He now finds you can make such a shot, but it makes the sound of a firecracker when a high velocity bullet goes through a windshield. So, I mean, here's Mac just concealing and covering up. He took him to the other side, the north side of the Triple Underpass, where there's another, or used to be another, above ground sewer opening. It's now been obfuscated and changed physically. I think where the city of Dallas is complicit in changing things around to serious researchers in an attempt to undermine or defeat their research. But the shooter said, oh yeah, this would be an excellent location. It happens to be the location from which we are convinced that the shot that entered Jack's right temple was fired, a frangible or exploding bullet that blew his brains out the back of his head. But Mack dismisses this on the grounds that, well, there were witnesses here and they would have heard such a shot, which is completely ridiculous. I mean, there's so much going on, and, you know, witnesses could have been persons who were complicit in the assassination, for God's sake. There are all kinds of reasons why this was complete rubbish. So if you go to Google, you'll find our analysis of this under the heading Another Attempted Reenactment of the Death of JFK. And you see where David Mandick, who's the leading expert on the assassination of JFK, especially with regard to its medical aspects, and I are explaining how this is a piece of disinformation. Now, if that has gone from 1963 right up to today, and this is, of course, one occurring in November 2008, I mean, there's a huge history there of manufactured evidence being thrown into the mix, and I could offer you many, many more examples. So it would not be surprising to me that given that background, that what's going on with regard to 9/11 is going to involve introducing a number of forms of fabricated footage that are red herrings intended to mislead. So it's entirely plausible to me, Ace, that some of this footage, like with the missing Verrazano Bridge, was created to be deliberately misleading. Now, that wouldn't mean that Rosalie, for example, or Killtown or whoever, if they talk about it and take it seriously, are being insincere or themselves attempting to mislead. But if they have a lesser degree of sophistication about these things than, say, you possess, and in my opinion, you're the gold standard in this area, then it wouldn't be surprising that they could look at it and interpret it differently. It's this element of subjectivity, meaning differences that occur between of the different backgrounds, knowledge, and understanding from person to person, that's inevitable until everyone is familiar with the same evidence and has the same background, knowledge, and understanding of the evidence and is applying the same principles, in which case we should all arrive at the same conclusions about what's true, what's false, and where we don't know enough. So my answer is, I think that there's a constant intrusion of distractions into the study, and that it's therefore very important to go back to the original sources, as you have, of course, been systematically endeavoring to do. Where I gather that Fox News may have been the original source for a lot of these videos, but then it cut off its origination and implied or has acted as though it was only a recipient or rebroadcasting stuff that came from other sources, which is a very clever move made by the intelligence community. I've seen it many times where you have one intelligence resource or asset makes a claim, and then another intelligence asset or resource comes along and says, oh, yes, isn't that a brilliant insight, as though they weren't acting in collusion. Here you could have Fox putting out false videos, and then, you know, basically erasing its archive, and then just republishing, you know, the videos that it already put out itself, now attributed to other sources like ABC or CBS or NBC or even CNN. Well, I gather some of the CNN stuff is also highly suspicious. But I can see all these kinds of things happening, and it doesn't necessarily impugn the character integrity of those who are arriving at different conclusions than we are, which is something we need to appreciate and be very respectful of, because it can't just be a function of their varying degrees of familiarity with the evidence or understanding of the technical aspects, whereas I hold you as the gold standard.
Right. Well, actually, there might be a little bit of a misunderstanding, because while these guys are claiming that there are missing buildings, improperly moving bridges, missing skylines, etc., actually there aren't. The moving bridge, for example, has been shown to be simply the effect of a high magnification on the zoom lens and ordinary perspective.
This ace just doesn't surprise me at all either, because we got, you know, many individuals pursuing this varying levels of expertise. I mean, I've been stunned by the attacks on me, for example, by persons who, over 9/11 blogger, which had no foundation whatsoever other than misunderstanding or not actually paying attention to things I've been saying. Stand by, we'll be right back with my special guest, Ace Baker. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal. Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, with my special guest today, Ace Baker, where Ace and I are reversing roles, and Ace is interviewing me instead of my interviewing him, and we're right now talking about research in relation to video fakery and some stuff that Ace regards as not a very high quality in relation to its research and the intrusion of what appear to be, you know, faked forms of fakery, some of which are relatively easily explainable if you understand enough about technology, just as you're suggesting, Ace, in relation to the moving Maranzano Bridge. If you do a close-up, then it can appear to be moving when, in fact, it actually isn't. Proceed.
To me, the interesting question is, are these guys, Killtown, Fred BS Registration, Nico, Simon Shack, and others, you know, are they sincerely mistaken, or are they disinformation agents? Did you know that that Nico and Fred have been producing a large number of web pages and information on the internet that claim that I am an agent for Mossad, and that I'm not who I say I am, and I'm not really a musician, and that I wear a wig, and that I've basically fabricated my entire identity, that I stole the identity of another guy named Ace Baker, which, by the way, there is another guy named Ace Baker for real. I've met the guy. He's a sound engineer. But putting all this stuff out there, and that Killtown promotes this stuff on his 9/11 movement forum, and at the same time has banned me from posting on that forum and banned a number of others who were asking the same kind of questions that I was and presenting the same kind of evidence, that is, taking these videos by Simon Shack and Fred and explaining what's really going on. Look, it's just perspective, or you know, here's your missing building, it's behind the bushes. And so my question is, you know, were you aware of that kind of stuff that was being put out there about me, and does that influence your decision as to whether you think these people are sincere or are perhaps insincere?
Well, this gets very complicated because, you know, they can be sincere but mistaken, or they can be insincere and know better. And it can be a very fine line. Now, there's some cases where I've just been, you know, compelled to dissociate with one or another. I mean, I take Rick Siegel at one point. I found Rick Siegel was an ally when there were tensions in the scholars movement. But, you know, I ultimately concluded that Rick was much more destructive than he was constructive, and that I just really couldn't associate myself with him any longer, to the extent that I had done so at all in the beginning. But so being moved from, you know, thinking that he was a force for good, I reassessed my opinion. I think Rosalie is about as sincere a person as I've known. I think you are very sincere, but see, I know you, and I know Rosalie not as well as I know you, I would say. Some of these others, I mean, I only know Killtown through our interaction, but Killtown seems to me to be very sincere, but I suspect Killtown doesn't have the level of sophistication that you possess regarding these technical issues. Now, on Simon Shack, and this Fred guy, I don't really think I know Fred particularly. The series, the September Clues series, is very, very stimulating and provocative, and it certainly provides a lot of what you might call prima facie proof of video fakery, meaning it's so persuasive that unless there's a powerful rebuttal, you're inclined to believe it. And I think that, you know, Simon Shack, therefore, has done a lot of good. On the other hand, we have, you know, Anthony Lawson, who's such a mixed bag, because Lawson's done the couple of very, very nice pieces like This Is an Orange and the Towers of Dust that I really like tremendously and often recommend. And yet it seems to me in some of his rebuttals to you or to Killtown or to others in relation to video fakery, he's been way off the mark, and so far off the mark that given his level of sophistication, it's difficult for me to reconcile his sincerity with his apparent technical competence and the positions he's adopting. So, you know, I mean, of the persons we're talking about, Lawson seems to me to be more likely to be a candidate for being an insincere critic of studies of video fakery. On the other hand, persons like this can provide a valuable role by perhaps showing cases or situations where the argument isn't as strong as it might otherwise be. I think ultimately it does... you know, causes more damage probably to be classifying persons as disinfo or not than simply to say, you know, they are wrong, and to argue the case intellectually in terms of the evidence and the principles of reasoning, where I think by and large that has been your approach. To me, it's disappointing that Killtown would cut you out of a forum, because, I mean, you're entitled to have your voice there. I was astounded when I was cut off from 9/11 Blogger. I had a blog there where I had about 7 articles that were very nice illustrations of the differences between Steve Jones and me, both in regard to his research and in regard to our attitude toward research, most of which can now be found on Scholar's website at 911scholars.org underneath the heading of the science of 9/11, if you just go to the home page and scroll down. But I had all this stuff there. There was a lot of interesting discussion that would take place on the site. when I would put up a piece. And I remember right toward what I didn't realize was going to be the end, one very astute individual whose name I cannot recall was saying how he'd spent a lot of time studying, you know, my dispute with Steve Jones and paid a lot of attention to the details. And he was convinced that either I was completely right or I was completely wrong. And I told him I thought that was a very appropriate observation. And I began to explain to him how he could tell whether I was completely right or completely wrong in relation to an issue beyond the ones he had been focusing on. And it was at this point that I was cut off completely. My blog was destroyed. It was vacated. I wasn't allowed to post. So you have all these, you know, you have this team of piranha fish, these scoundrels, in my opinion, who just, you know, will attack and attack and attack. I mean, two of the most prominent are Victoria Ashley, of course, who I cannot believe remains the press spokesman for this organization calling itself Truth and Justice, since she represents neither. And John Gold over the 9/11 blogger. John Gold was just vicious and had no justification whatsoever for the vast majority of his attacks on me. But the fact that they can have a site like that where they would attack me and there's no opportunity for me to even post or rebuttal is a disgrace. It's intellectually despicable. It is abusive. And it makes the site really a function, a propaganda outlet. And therefore, I sought to mediate between you and Killtown when he was cutting you off of the forum, because it's intellectually despicable that you should not have the opportunity to offer your arguments. And even if you present them in a way that others might find provocative, sometimes you're just very casual in the way in which you make your points, and sometimes you're sarcastic. But I don't have any problem with that. I mean, nobody should be offended. I mean, if we're looking for the truth, we need to have an intellectual interaction and evaluate arguments and use one another to test one another's ideas and propositions to see which is the most defensible. In my opinion, in most of these engagements, you have had the most defensible argument. And I wish that Killtown would restore your activism on his forum. And 9/11 blogger, it seems to me, has just made a mockery of itself. It's cut out so many people who have things to say. Kevin Barrett was cut out, presumably because he would have any interaction with me. And of course, Judy Wood, I don't think, was ever allowed there that I know of. Morgan Reynolds, I'm sure, wouldn't be allowed there. You probably would not be allowed there. I mean, it's disgusting. I mean, you know, you can't find truth if you aren't willing to undergo the process that would eventually yield truth, which has got to do with critical discussion and an unfettered debate. We don't find any of that on that forum, nor I infer, though with a lesser degree of seriousness, perhaps, on Killtown's.
Yes, I was also banned from 9/11 blogger, banned from JREF forum, of course, but that's the official government hangout.
Yeah.
I was banned from Loose Change. I was banned from Pilots. Pilots for 9/11.
This is just absurd. It's intellectually self-defeating. I mean, if you have a sincere commitment to truth, then you want to invite everyone who has a contribution to make to participate in I would say that you, among all, have contributions to make. I don't know, you know anyone, I would say, has more contributions to make, and most have lesser contributions to make. So obviously, from my point of view, you ought to be a participant on all of these fora, and I think it's really revealing who they won't allow to participate. And it's when they undertake measures like that that you tend to become convinced that maybe there is, in fact, a disinformation operation afoot. I've some time now been convinced that Blogger, 9/11 Blogger, is not a serious forum in relation to searching for truth about 9/11, although it has some of the external trappings that make it appear as though it is. But the role of some persons, and like Ashley and John Gold and others, has convinced me that this is really not a site that's intended to promote the search for truth, but rather to manage and contain it, to constrain it, to be a politically correct site within very narrow boundaries that are completely antithetical to the scientific investigation. And therefore, I hold 9/11 Blogger in contempt.
Yeah. And that's That's what's driving me. It's driving me crazy, Jim. I have to be honest. It's, you know, there's, we have a Los Angeles 9/11 Truth LA has a monthly meeting. It's I actually have never been, but I've been in contact with the leaders of that and have asked to go down and participate in one of these casual Saturday meetings. And give a little presentation, and they're not having it. I'm not even welcome to go.
Is this, you know, Peter Tottenham?
Correct. Yeah, him, and I believe he might have recently resigned. I don't know. I haven't been paying too much attention the last few months, but it's you know, it's just one place after another, and it really makes me wonder. You know, you speak. You speak highly of David Ray Griffin, and I do too. You know, he a couple years ago was very influential to me. I very much appreciate his scholarly approach, both as a, you know, as an author and as a speaker. I would listen to his speeches, and I loved his methodical, sort of soft spoken, but just I thought he did a brilliant job of explaining why the official story cannot possibly be true. Yes. And of course, his academic credentials, even though he's a theologian, but just his academic career is really gives a lot of credibility. And I was just a big fan of his. But I was very surprised to learn about a year ago, I saw a different speech by him, in fact a couple different ones, where he was advocating global democracy or a one world government. And it seems to me that that really is the goal of 9/11, it was to sort of continue to pave the way towards more and more centralization of government, both within, you know, the expansion of government, both within the United States and also in consolidating governmental forces worldwide. So my question is, I know you speak very highly of David Ray Griffin, do you think that global democracy is a good idea?
Well, let me address this in two or three different ways. One is, I agree with a lot of David Ray Griffin's research, but not with all. And for some reason, we're getting a little feedback now, so the audience no doubt is hearing it if I'm hearing it. For example, I think he's gone way too far along the Steve Jones path in relation to the molten metal business. Judy, when I had her on, and I would go over some of these issues, and she'd talk about how we have this kind of mist, but it can't be steam, because if it were steam, then workers who are in the midst of this would be, you know, suffering severe harm to their bodies. You can't have the basement of the North Tower have puddles of water and workmen walking around if there's all this molten metal around. If there'd been all this water, if 11 million gallons of water were dumped on the World Trade Center in the first couple of days, then you would have had massive steam explosions if there's massive piles of molten metal. So, I mean, this is one of the issues on which I've taken Steve Jones to task, in part because he's using what appear to be fake photographs to support the claim of this massive molten metal, and because he's not acknowledging it, you know, that you have to be convinced of the evidence. I mean, I wrote David Ray Griffin a fairly extensive critique about the molten metal, and so far as I know, it's never affected him. But words are cheap. You know, the fact that a number of witnesses claim they saw molten metal, and one of them said flowing like lava, and Judy said, where? You know, where is it flowing? Where's it got to flow to? And I think that was a very appropriate observation on her part. So, you know, I don't agree with Griffin about certain aspects of his research. I think he's been the leading public representative of the 9/11 movement, and that by and large it's been extremely positive and constructive. I'll return to this momentarily. Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, with my special guest, Ace Baker.
Take these broken wings and learn to fly all your life. You are only waiting for this moment to arise. Blackbird singing in the dead of night. Take these sunken eyes and learn to see. All your your life. You were only waiting for this moment to be free. Blackbird, fly. Blackbird, fly. Into the line of a dark black.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, with my special guest today, Ace Baker. Ace and I are reversing roles, and Ace is interviewing me. He was asking about my views in relation to the work of David Griffin, and I was explaining to Ace that we're getting a lot of background sounds now because the mics are live even during our breaks, so Ace may want to consider that. About my views toward David Ray Griffin, and I was explaining why I endorse most of his critique of the official account of 9/11. I think he's blundered when it comes to the molten metal business, and then Judy had raised a lot of issues that I also faced with David Ray Griffin trying to disabuse him of that belief. But now, also in relation to some of his theological work, he has an argument that evolution implies atheism. This, in my opinion, commits a logical blunder, because evolution is neutral with regard to the existence or the non-existence of God. It doesn't imply theism, and it doesn't imply atheism. And it's compatible with either, though I personally am an agnostic, recognizing that there is no way to prove the existence of God, nor to prove the non-existence of God, and therefore it's very important for us to preserve our intellectual scruples when it comes to these theological issues. In any case, I took Griffin to task on a presidential here in a special election devoted to the relationship between religion and evolution. In a journal devoted to methodology and epistemology entitled Synthes, which for 10 years I co-edited. But then when it comes to these questions that Ace is raising about world government, I'm a very strong proponent of the United Nations. I believe that all nations ought to be treated with respect, that the United States is grossly abusing its position, its right to veto as a permanent member of the Security Council, that Israel is grossly disrespecting the rights of the Palestinians and committing offenses that I liken to those of the Nazis in World War II, and it saddens me tremendously that that's the case, because Israel is, in my opinion, the greatest, together with the United States, the two greatest terrorist states in the world today. And it's a shame that that should be the case. And I'm hopeful, but possibly utterly naive, in believing that perhaps Obama will do something to restore our moral standing in the world. But if he's not going to speak out against such grotesque abuses and atrocities as are taking place today, and if in fact he's going to persevere with big tax breaks for corporations and minimal benefits for the ordinary taxpayer and working man, then I'm going to lose all faith in Barack Obama, even though I've been a steadfast supporter of his up until this point. Now, Ace, I have to ask then, just what kind of world government is David Ray Griffin talking about? Because, you know, there's some forms of international cooperation represented in my mind by the United Nations that I support wholeheartedly. But the idea of, David Corton's When Corporations Rule the World, the idea that the World Trade Organization should be the supreme entity, the abolition of workers' rights and environmental rights and labor rights and women's rights and gay rights and all that, which human beings are entitled to by virtue of being human beings, those are things that I can't imagine David Ray Griffin would want to override. And therefore, I'm puzzled, as to just what form this takes. I recall we had an exchange, it may have been a conversation, but probably an email, where he said something to me about that I shouldn't take for granted that he didn't hold some sort of views about one world that I might, not share. But since I don't share his views about molten metal, I don't share his views about evolution and atheism, I may well not share his views about world government. Can you tell me more of just what David Griffin is proposing?
Well, I don't know that it's that he's made it clear. From my viewpoint, I don't see anything great about democracy, whether it's whether it's local or national or global, unless it's voluntary. There's nothing wrong with voluntary democracy, people, groups of any size getting together and voluntarily deciding to be bound by the decision of a majority. But when it crosses the line from being a voluntary organization into one in which people have no choice whether they belong or not to this democracy, then I think that is the exact line where it crosses from good into evil. And irrespective of whether it's a group of 10 people or 300 million or 6 billion, it really makes no difference to me. But there's other things there.
Let me squeeze in a couple comments on what you just said. It suggests to me that you didn't have a chance to read Render Unto Darwin, which, of course, I sent you in anticipation of this because it addresses issues that are directly related here. For example, majority rule without minority rights it descends into the tyranny of the mob. This is why classic utilitarianism is ultimately an indefensible moral philosophy. According to classical utilitarianism, an action is right or wrong insofar as it is the action among the available alternatives that produces the greatest net good for the community as a whole, where you have to deal in terms of net good, because some persons may be impacted in a way that reduces their happiness, others in ways that increase their happiness. And it might be the case, for example, that a slave state, where slavery is immoral, if any human action is immoral, could be justified by a classic utilitarian calculus if you had the right percentage, say 85% masters and 15% slaves. That might be the maximally happiness-producing arrangement of society, because while the slaves are very unhappy at their inferior and subordinate status, it makes the masters, the 85%, so much happier to have someone to mow the lawns, do the dishes, change the baby's diapers, and all that sort of thing, that it is actually the greatest happiness-producing arrangement of all. I contrast that with, say, for example, what would be the effects on health if the government were to round up 100 smokers at random every year, put them on television, and shoot them. Well, probably enthusiasm for smoking would dwindle. We'd have fewer incidents of lung cancer, cancer of the esophagus, cancer of the lips and tongue and so forth. Health care premiums would drop. People would live longer, healthier lives. If that is the method that would bring about, say, the greatest happiness benefit for the community, should we therefore endorse putting 100 smokers at random on television and shooting them? Obviously not. It's got to do with respect for the individual, and therefore, you know, when we're talking about a democracy of any form, it can't just be a simple, pure majority rule democracy, but it has to be majority rule combined with minority rights, really individual rights that apply to every single individual, whether they're in a majority or in a minority on any particular issue. And let me further add that I think the ultimate justification for democracy, provided, of course, it's qualified by minority or individual rights, is that it is a form of shared responsibility for decision-making when the consequences of those decisions are going to affect everyone. In other words, if decisions are going to be made, then and they're going to affect you, then ought you to have the right to participate in the making of those decisions in a complex, sophisticated society like the United States. Of course, this is done by our representatives. But it's why there's such a dereliction of duty and failure of the system when we don't have a vote to go to war but allow the administration to do it for us. Stand by. We'll be right back with my special guest, Ace Baker, Jim Fetzer, on The Real Deal. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, with my special guest today, Ace Baker. Where Ace and I are reversing roles, and instead of me interviewing him, he is interviewing me. Ace, I'd just like to make one more comment, which is something I wouldn't want us to overlook, namely corporations. In my view, corporations in particular, when they're guided by the maxim enunciated by Milton Friedman, that their only obligation to society is maximizing profits, which really means they only have an obligation to their stockholders, not to all of those whose interests might be affected by their actions, which we can refer to more broadly as stakeholders. When the corporations operate to maximize profits for their stockholders, that can lead to them providing, you know, below fair wages, looking for the cheapest forms of labor, evading taxes, trying to create monopolies, exploiting natural resources, not cleaning up the environment, which tells me that corporations can be moral entities. Nonprofits are a nice example, but that they're frequently immoral, and when they're guided by that maxim to maximize profits, corporations are inherently immoral. So it's really gross. This is a serious problem we have in the United States and in other free market situations, where ours is, of course, a highly qualified form. We have all kinds of crony capitalism, welfare, corporate welfare, and all this kind of stuff. What are we doing giving $700 billion to the bankers and financiers who got us into this mess? They would have been, the country would have been much better off if they took that money and divided it up and gave it to the taxpayers, everyone making less than $250,000 a year, in my opinion. But I turn the mic back to you, Ace.
Well, you know, I guess when it comes to economics, we just agree to disagree, and I'll fully admit that I'm the weird one. You know, I'm the one who doesn't belong, really. Even after 9/11, you know, most people they support government, and I know that you're optimistic about this new administration. I'm not. I don't accept the legitimacy of government per se. I've asked, and nobody can really give me a justification for the state.
This is why I wanted you to read.
Let me go on, Jim. I mean, if 9/11 won't convince people that government is evil, then nothing will. I think what I've learned is that people want government. They support what government does. And what government does is murder, theft, and counterfeiting. Everybody else evidently has no problem with that. But I just can't accept it.
I tried
really hard to produce good science about the 9/11 airplane videos, and I succeeded. I proved video compositing. I did. I solved 9/11, but nobody cares.
Well, I don't know why.
And not even anyone within this so-called truth movement. I mean, Dylan Avery, he got co-opted and he ruined his movie. And Stephen Jones lied to me, and he lied to everyone. Judy Wood lied, and Rob Balsamo lied, and Simon Shack's movies, you might like them, they're completely false. They're 99% false. And I've been banned from every so-called truth forum out there. And Killtown and Fred, they're
Ace, I care so much about your work
about me, and I can't take it anymore.
I care so much about your work.
Stop doing 9/11.
Ace, look.
My
people who are very, listen to me a second. People who are very original in the field are often not appreciated at the time. I have so much confidence in your work that it's a prominent part of the new book I'm editing on the 9/11 controversies. I feature you regularly on this program.
I feature you. I need to say, my daughters, you know, girls, I love you, and I know that 9/11 has taken a lot of me away from you, and I'm sorry for that, and I hope that someday that you'll forgive me for that. And to my wife, Claire, I just want to say that I love you, and I'm sorry. I'm really sorry for everything. And to my parents, Mom, Dad, I miss you, and I want to come home.
Ace, I want to come home. We need you, Ace. We need you. I need you. The world needs you. These are temporary problems of. Innovators in their fields are frequently unappreciated. My God, Galileo was subjected to an inquisition, prosecuted by the church. Galileo, for God's sake.
I'm coming home.
I hope this is not for real. I hope this is not for real. I have such a high opinion of this man. He is a magnificent human being. He is a tortured soul. What can I say? I've been very upset with that Ace has felt so despondent. Are you there? Are you there in the studio? Are we still on the air?
Yes.
Is this you, Danny?
Yes.
Have we been cut off with Ace? Is Ace still there or is Ace not there?
I show his connection still there.
His connection is still there. Well, Christ Almighty, I don't know quite what to do about this. I'm going to try calling his home and see if I can get Claire, his wife, whom I've met. And I hope this isn't what it sounds as though it is. I've got their phone system. Claire, this is Jim Fetzer. Listen, I've had Ace on the show today, and he was interviewing me, but I don't know, something may have happened. He was sounding very despondent, and I need for you to check on him to make sure everything's okay. Will you please do that as soon as you get this message? Please check. I'm very concerned. Please check. I'm very concerned. And I hope desperately that nothing untoward has happened here. What can I say? Ace and I have had conversations before about his despondency, but I sought to emphasize to him that, persons who are innovative in different fields are often unappreciated in the beginning. Stand by. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal. We'll be right back.
Listen in to The Real Deal with Dr. Jim Fetzer every Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday from 1 to 3 p.m. on Freedom Underground Radio.
What would you think if I sang out at you? Would you stand up and walk out on me? Got a key. Oh, I can buy a little help from my friend.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal. I have been with Ace Baker here, and I'm terribly worried that something has happened to Ace. He has displayed despondency. We have had extended conversations. I've been very worried about the man whom I hold in very high esteem. As you heard during our conversation, sometimes I felt as though he and I were the only two who were really trying to discover the truth about 9/11, not literally, but figuratively. There's been so much turmoil in the 9/11 movement. Persons of genius, of whom Ace is unquestionably, in my judgment, one.
News, politics, rumors, rants.
Left you hanging there with a major cliffhanger before we went to break. I was out in the other room getting an update from Jim Fetzer about what happened on his program today. We can report that Ace Baker is alive. We do have Jim Fetzer with us now on the line to give us an update on exactly what might have happened. Jim, thank you for joining us. What the hell, dude?
Well, that's my question too, Ace. About 5 minutes ago, I was called by the California Highway Patrol, well, actually the LA Police Department, who had been given the responsibility to investigate after I called it in, and they told me that he was alive, that he hadn't taken his own life.
And that's all we know? You haven't had a chance to talk to him and find out? I mean,
I haven't had a chance to talk to him, but I may give him a piece of my mind. I mean, this is a really outrageous thing to do, you know, to simulate a suicide on a radio program. It was I had him on several times, of course. He's, in my opinion, the leading expert on the study of the videos and films in New York City. He's not only concluded there was video fakery, he also strongly believes that it was used to conceal that there were no planes. He has a very sophisticated analysis, which is going to be in my second 9/11 book entitled The 9/11 Controversies. But he had wanted to come on this time and interview me instead of my interviewing him. So we had a reversal of roles here. Mm-hmm. And, of course, it was a two-hour program, and we were 45 minutes into the second hour when he became despondent, talking about how those who were doing research in 9/11 had rejected him, even though he had solved the problem, that it was a matter of video compositing, adding images to real images, the images added being, of course, of the planes, and that he was being rejected by researchers here and there, and I was seeking to impress upon him how I most certainly had not rejected his work, that I consider it to be the best being done, that he has superior background and knowledge, but he was going on about how he had neglected his children, neglected his wife, how he missed his parents terribly and was going to join them, and then we heard what sounded like a muffled gunshot.
Wow. Well, I got to tell you, Jim, I'm glad that he's okay.
Well, so am I.
I'm glad he's okay.
So
I mean, I don't mind that this has, you know, somewhat interrupted our... we reported a couple of big stories here on our program today, but as long as he's okay, I'm glad. It's just... wow, I mean, what a thing to happen. So that's all we know at this point, though.
Well, we know a little more because he had called me a couple of months ago, and we'd had a long talk, and I could tell he was feeling despondent. And I explained to him how my own mother had committed suicide when I was 11 years old, so I was very familiar with the, something like that, and the profound effects it have on those who are left behind. And after this event occurred, we had silence, and the fake music came on, and I spent the rest of the program talking about suicide and its ramifications, not knowing what was going on here and trying to sort out in my own mind how I should deal with it. I was reluctant to, call the police initially, thinking that this is going to be terrible for the family. I called and left two messages for his wife, ultimately three. But I realized I had to call the police, so I tried the California Highway Patrol, and they shifted me to the Los Angeles Police Department. And about 15 or 20 minutes ago, I was called by the police officer who said he was just approaching the house and wanted to confirm what I had reported. And he said he'd get back to me. And then, as I mentioned about now 7 or 8 minutes ago, I was called and assured that he is, in fact, alive.
Does something like this, Jim, we're with Dr. Jim Fetzer, who does The Real Deal on this network right before my show. I think it's 3 or 4 days a week, right, Jim? I mean, does this hurt the credibility of the TV fakery proponents, people who are out there talking about that? I mean, does this somehow damage your credibility at all?
Well, I hope not, Jack. I mean, I think it was a dumb thing to do, and I'm going to, you know, have to, you know, question Ace about what he thought he was pulling off here, but it was, you know, I suppose it could fall into the category of a stunt, but, you know, to me, it's profoundly depressing. This guy is so good. I'm seeking to explain how, you know, people who are making profound inroads in their fields are frequently not appreciated at the time. I even brought up Galileo, who, of course, was persecuted by the Catholic Church, this, incidentally, being the year of Galileo. And, you know, there are going to be all kinds of commemorations of his profound work. This guy may have been the most important scientist in the history of Western thought.
Absolutely. And Socrates, another good example there. I mean, I want people to understand. I mean, this, you getting information out, I'm talking to my listeners now, Jim. This isn't about getting credibility. This isn't about people acknowledging all of your hard work. This is about getting to the truth. And we need to stop being so self-centered, if I may say, not accusing him or you or anyone else, but we need to realize this thing's bigger than ourselves. It doesn't matter if we get credibility or people acknowledge our hard work. What matters is that we set the record straight and put this stuff on the record and let people decide for themselves. And if anyone out there is despondent enough to commit suicide all over all of this, please don't do it.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more, Jack. And, you know, especially as I was emphasizing there after this event, to complete the program, I was explaining, you know, the consequences for those who are left behind. I mean, it just had, my mother's death had a profound effect on me and my younger brother. I have a full brother who is the middle of the three of us, and he was somehow less affected by all of this. But my younger brother, actually a half-brother by my stepfather and mother, he and I were both profoundly affected. In fact, it's taken many, many years late into my adulthood, even since my retirement just a couple of years ago, for me to begin to appreciate the profundity of those effects.
Yeah. Jim, let's say for the record that neither you nor I or my guest in studio, Freeman, have any compunction to commit suicide. If anything happens to us, you can pretty much chalk it up to foul play.
You can say that again, Jack. That's absolutely right. My God, yes, no. I have been very robust in my enjoyment of life, and I'm willing to persevere to the bitter end.
Right.
But suicide is not an option.
Jim Fetzer does the very controversial program on this network, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, starting, I guess, at 11 o'clock, Jim. Is it 11 to 3 or is it 12
to 3? Well, it'll be 11 Pacific. It's 1 to 3 Central.
Yeah. All right. I assume that you'll have some updates on your program tomorrow on tomorrow's show, so that if people, you know, want to find out more about this, they can tune in and listen to you then.
Yes, absolutely, Jack.
Okay, well, I'm just glad this guy's okay. That's the first thing, I think. All right, thank you for calling and clearing
that
up, Jim.
Right. Thanks, Jack.
I appreciate it. There goes Jim Fetzer. Bye.